Let me start off with a with selected apologies. First apology is I'm sorry to read this talk, but if I don't, I forget. I end up forgetting everything important to say. The other apology is that there are versions of this talk fairly close to this one that I know at least a couple of you have heard before. I'm sorry. It seems that I've been appointed something like the official curmudgeon of the Many Worlds interpretation, or Everett Pictures generally. And this is sort of what I have to say about it. The talk does keep evolving because every time I give it, I get responses to it that I hadn't heard before, and some of those prompt further thoughts which get included in here. Last time I was here was the first time I heard an interesting argument from Wojciech Zurek, which will be responded to. No, I didn't mean that. No, excuse me. That came out wrong. I mean, there is an interesting argument of Wojciech's that I heard for the first time last time I was here. And I've added a little section to this responding to that argument. Okay, with those apologies in mind.
Or do you mean that plus the assumption that all the worlds are real?
No, I mean, I think I mean just first, that the wave function is a complete description of the world, and that it invariably evolves in accord with the Schrodinger equation or some relativistic generalization thereof. Right. Okay. Let's start by saying what the problem is that Everett tried to solve. Let me start off, that is, by reminding you of what I take to be the simplest and most beautiful and most seductive way of understanding what it was that Everett first decisively put his finger on 50 or so years ago. There's supposed to be a problem with the linear, deterministic, unitary, quantum mechanical equations of motion. And that problem, in its cleanest and most vivid and most radical form, runs like this. The equations of motion, if they apply to everything, entail that in the event that somebody measures, say, the x spin of an electron, whose y spin is initially up, then the state of the world, when the experiment is over, is with certainty going to be a superposition with equal coefficients of one state in which the x spin of the electron is up, and the measuring device indicates that that spin is up, and the human experimenter believes that that spin is up, and another state in which the x spin of the electron is down, and the measuring device indicates that that spin is down, and the human experimenter believes that that spin is down. And superpositions like that, on the standard way of thinking about what it is to be in a superposition, are situations in which there is no matter of fact about what the value of the x spin of the electron is, or about what the measuring device indicates about that value, or about what the human experimenter believes about that value. And the problem with that is that we know with certainty, by means of direct introspection, that there is a matter of fact about what we believe about the value of the x spin of an electron like that once we're done measuring it. And so the superposition just described can't possibly be the way experiments like that end up. And so the quantum mechanical equations of motion must be false or incomplete. Or that, at any rate, is the conventional wisdom. And it was Everett who first pointed us in the direction of a scientifically realist strategy for resisting this conventional wisdom. It was Everett who first remarked that the problem I just rehearsed is, in fact, on closer examination, an ill-posed problem. It was Everett who first argued more particularly that the same linearity of the quantum mechanical equations of motion which gives rise to the troubling superpositions of brain states described above also radically undermines the reliability of the sorts of introspective reports with which those superpositions are supposed to be incompatible. That is, it was Everett who pointed out that that same linearity, if we are in one of these superpositions, is going to make us think in a certain well-defined sense that we're not. And the suggestion here, the intriguing possibility here, was that perhaps there's nothing wrong with the equations of motion and nothing incomplete about them after all. And there have been a host of questions ever since Everett first brought this up about how to go on from this observation. And I want to focus on one particularly difficult such question in my remarks here, the question of how to make sense in the context of the sort of picture of the world that Everett seems to be suggesting, of all of the apparently indispensable quantum mechanical talk of probabilities. And the talk I have in mind here includes our use of probabilities as a guide to life and as a component of explanation and as a tool of confirmation and so on. There's a simple and straightforward and perfectly obvious worry here, a worry that'll be worth putting on the table at the outset in two slightly different forms. One, Everettian pictures of the world are apparently going to have no room in them for ignorance about the future. The worry is that the Everettian picture of the world, whatever precisely that picture is going to turn out to be, is going to be completely deterministic. And moreover, it's going to impose none of the sorts of ignorance of the initial conditions that allow us to make sense of probabilistic talk in deterministic theories like classical mechanics or Bohmian mechanics, say. Two, Everettian pictures of the world are apparently not going to be susceptible of confirmation or disconfirmation by means of experiment, or not at any rate by means of anything even remotely like the sorts of experiments that we normally take to be confirmatory or disconfirmatory of quantum mechanics. Why, for example, should it come as a surprise on a picture like this to see what we would ordinarily consider a low probability string of experimental results? Why should such a result cast any doubt on the truth of this theory, as it does, in fact, cast doubt on quantum mechanics? Okay, here are a couple of first passes. Interesting but manifestly unsuccessful first passes.
Right. One, even if you're talking about the wave function of a subsystem, which was supposed to, was evolved linearly, the future is not certain for whatever variable, say, position that you might.
But the comprehensive state of the world in the future is certain.
Yeah, but the comprehensive
everything
state of the subsystem is
only,
also certain.
Only
as long
if you
as
knew
you
it in the past. Right?
Yeah,
you
that's
have
right.
To know it precisely.
You have to know it precisely, but there's nothing. First of all, I don't know what it means to say you have to know it precisely. If I'm doing an X-spin measurement, to the extent that I know that the Y-spin starts out up, okay, to whatever accuracy with which I know that the Y-spin starts out up, I know exactly what's going to happen towards the future. That is, the sensitivity to the exact initial state isn't interestingly sensitive in the way that it is in statistical mechanics or something like that. Okay, there aren't instabilities there. Okay, there isn't any reason. That is, there are two. Maybe we should save some of this for discussion because it's a long talk. But there are two circumstances in which prior to quantum mechanics, we're used to using probabilistic language. Okay, in both of these circumstances, but for different reasons, it's because we're for one reason or another ignorant about what's going to happen. Sources of ignorance might be indeterminism, you know, stochasticity in the dynamics itself. Or it might be there's no stochasticity in the dynamics, but there's some relevant kind of ignorance of the initial conditions. Okay. In the Everettian case, neither of these is present. Okay. Of course, there's ignorance of initial conditions. We don't have perfectly precise measuring instruments, but it's not ignorance of a relevant kind. It's not like what's going on in statistical mechanics. It's not like what's going on.
If you're saying it's not relevant for explaining the probability.
That's right. That's right.
Of the later measure.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's
that,
right.
That wasn't there even in the quantum mechanics of subsystems, right? That is the measure.
I'm not sure what you mean by the quantum mechanics of subsystems. If you mean the Copenhagen interpretation, well, there was stochasticity there.
No, where?
There was in the collapse postulate.
No, before in the wave function collapse, you still predict probabilities for the speed.
No, the probabilities are about what the wave function is going to collapse onto. The probabilities are about the outcomes of measurements.
Well, that's not the way I understand quantum.
So we should have a talk about that. We should have a talk about that. Yeah.
And what if the initial conditions involve a superposition? How would you know that?
Say it again.
What if the initial conditions involve a superposition? How would you know that? That's something that it's impossible to know, and then somehow it could change the future.
No.
Like that possible or
no, 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 no. That's not correct either. If I know that on my branch of the wave function, okay, I have memories which I have memories of past experiments which locate me on a particular branch. Okay. As long as those memories survive, there isn't going to be subsequent interference between that branch and other branches. Okay. So on my branch, which is what's going to be relevant for me, I'm perfectly and completely able to predict what's going to happen. There's going to be this future branching of my branch. As long as the memories which locate me on that branch in the first place survive, the existence of those memories guarantees that there isn't going to be interference between those various different branches. Yeah.
The point of both point one and two is this is the question, is the point of both one and two, and is this direction going to develop the following? Since the Schrodinger equation is deterministic and there's no mention of probabilities,
right.
How is it the probabilities enter?
I mean, that's the point one and two are meant to be an extremely preliminary way of raising the puzzle. I'm going to try to be much more precise about that. But yeah, I think the answer to your question is yes. Yes, okay. I'm going to try to raise, I'm going to try to say what the puzzle is a good deal more precisely than that. But these are supposed to be, as it were, first red flags that there's something puzzling here. That's right. There's supposed to be probabilities here. Where are they? The whole theory is deterministic. Right. Okay. Good. Here are some first passes at coming to grips with these words. First passes, as I say, which I think can be pretty quickly dismissed as inadequate. Everybody's first unreflective reaction to these words is to think of the probability in question here. That is when they first hear it, is to think of the probability in question here as something like the probability that the real me or the original me or the sentient me or something like that ends up at the conclusion of the measurement on this or that particular branch of the wave function. And the serious discussion of these questions, it seems to me, gets underway precisely with the realization that insofar as the Everett picture is committed to the proposition that quantum mechanical wave functions amount to metaphysically complete descriptions of the world, these thoughts make no sense. There just isn't any such thing as the original me or the real me or anything like that. There was an attempt by Barry Lower and I, 25 or so years ago, a preposterous attempt, I think, at going very explicitly dualist in the so-called many minds interpretation so as to have something for the probabilities genuinely to apply to. But if you want to stick with anything like the spirit of Everett, with anything like the claim that the wave function is a complete description of the world, these stories that you tend to tell yourself about the real me going here or there or the original me going here or there just don't make any sense. Okay, here's another idea.
Sorry, David, when you said the many minds, you're...
Barry and I fooled
him.
Say it again?
Were you saying something negative about?
I was. Yeah. I think that's. I mean, even at the time, we were proposing this as a sort of
logical possibility that's interesting to explore. I think, and I think we even thought then that you'd have to be crazy to think that that was something that it was reasonable to take seriously as a candidate for the fundamental physical theory of the world. Yeah.
So you've changed some of your many minds.
I don't think we ever took them seriously in that way. Anyway, here's another idea. Yeah.
One question. Is there an attitude about probability that it has to be the frequency of something that underlies your experience?
Well, I'll talk a lot about that later. I mean, I was about to say the short answer is yes, but I think that's too short of an answer. I'll talk a lot about that later, and you obviously have reservations about that, so you should please bring them up. Please bring them up, but I'll be talking quite explicitly about that later. Okay, here's another idea. Suppose that we measure the x-spin of each of an infinite ensemble of electrons, where each of the electrons in the ensemble is initially prepared in the state alpha x-spin up plus beta x-spin down. Then it can easily be shown that in the limit, as the number of measurements already performed goes to infinity, the state of the world approaches an eigenstate of the frequency, of the relative frequency of, say, x spin up results with eigenvalue, absolute value of alpha squared. And note that the limit we're dealing with here is a perfectly concrete and flat-footed limit of a sequence of vectors in Hilbert space, not a limit of probabilities of the sort that we're used to dealing with in applications of the probabilistic law of large numbers. And the thought has occurred to a number of investigators over the years. This is a thought that occurred to Sidney Cullman. This is a thought that I guess occurred to me in certain other contexts too, that perhaps all it means to say that the probability of the outcome of a measurement of the x spin of an electron in the state alpha x spin up plus beta x spin down is alpha squared is that if an infinite ensemble of such experiments were to be performed, the state of the world would with certainty approach, as you go towards infinity, an eigenstate of the frequency of, say, x spin up results with eigenvalue absolute square of alpha. And what's particularly beautiful and seductive about that thought is the intimation that perhaps the Everett picture will turn out at the end of the day to be the only picture of the world on which probabilities fully and flat-footedly and non-circularly make sense. But the business of parlaying this thought into a fully worked out account of probability in the Everett picture quickly runs into very familiar and very discouraging, I think, sorts of trouble. One doesn't know what to say, for example, about finite runs of experiments of the kinds that we actually do. And one doesn't know what to say about the fact that the world is, after all, very unlikely ever to be in an eigenstate of my undertaking to carry out any particular measurement of anything. Okay. Makes sense in a way that's easy to see. Yeah. Good. Lately, there's been a very imaginative and very intriguing and very intensely discussed third pass at making sense of this talk. This is a collection of ideas due to David Deutsch and David Wallace and Hilary Greaves, who's here, and Simon Saunders, and other people as well. A collection of ideas which exploits the formal apparatus of decision theory. And that's, I think, by far the most interesting attempt we have on the table so far to make sense of this probabilistic talk. And that's at least what I had planned to be talking about mostly here. So let me start to talk about that. Let me start off with what seems to me to be the clearest and most straightforward and most radical version of this idea. This is Hilary Greaves' version. I think, you might have an opinion about this, I think this is what Deutsch thinks too. That is, he thinks about the fishing picture. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think so, I'm not sure.
It's the one that Hilary has been very explicit in laying out. It's something that David Wallace helpfully calls the fishing program. And
The point of departure in this train of thought is to bite the bullet very hard, is to eschew any talk of probabilities whatsoever. That is to acknowledge, frankly, that in a world like this, this being a deterministic world with none of the relevant sorts of ignorance of initial conditions, there aren't any probabilities. The situation is rather this. The Schrodinger evolution is the complete story of the evolution of the world. Every branch in the appropriate basis supports an actual experience of the observer. Every quantum mechanically possible outcome of a measurement occurs with certainty. What I should rationally expect on undertaking a measurement is to see all, or Hillary sometimes likes to prefers to say, is to see each of its possible outcomes with certainty. In every sequence of similar measurements, all of the possible frequencies occur and are experienced by the observer with certainty, period. And now the following question gets raised. Imagine that this is actually the way the world is. And suppose that our preferences are given. Suppose that we want, say, to maximize our financial holdings and we don't care about anything else. How is it rational for us to act? What is it rational for us to decide? And there's a whole collection of arguments to the effect that the square of the absolute value of the coefficient of this or that particular branch is going to play precisely the same formal role in rational deliberations about how to act in a world like that as the probability of this or that particular state of affairs plays in such deliberations in the analogous, genuinely chancy world. There's a whole collection of arguments, that is, to the effect that the square amplitudes in the many worlds interpretation are going to play precisely the same role in decision theory as probabilities do in chancy theories. And the thought is that that's all we need. The thought is that that exhausts the role that probabilities actually play in our lives. How precisely should we think of these square amplitudes on the fishing picture if the sort of argument described above succeeds? Well, what they're certainly not, remember, are probabilities. Greaves thinks that what these sorts of arguments establish, if they succeed, is that rational agents must treat the square amplitude as what she calls a caring measure. A measure of the degree to which we care about, the degree to which we're concerned about or interested in the situation on this or that particular branch. Our goal in making decisions, then, is to maximize the average over all the branches of the product of how well we do on a branch and the degree to which we care about what goes on that branch. And I have two distinct sorts of worries about this strategy. One worry has to do with whether or not these arguments actually succeed in establishing the particular point they're advertised as establishing, whether or not, that is, these arguments actually succeed in establishing that the square of the absolute value of the coefficient of this or that particular branch is going to play precisely the same formal role in rational deliberations about how to act in a world like that as the probability of this or that particular state of affairs plays in such deliberations in the analogous, genuinely chancy world. And the other worry has to do with whether or not establishing that would, even if we could establish it, would amount to anything along the lines of a solution to the puzzle about probabilities in the many worlds interpretation. Let me talk about the second one of these worries. Sure.
Question about what the program is.
Sure.
For example, the modern theory, right, considers sets of history, mm-hmm. right, for which there are no observers in them whatsoever, and assigns probabilities.
There aren't observers? You mean there's a fact about observers are absent? I'm not sure.
I'd say the observers are absent.
You mean, I don't understand. That sounds like a theory that's just straightforwardly incompatible with the way the world is. There are observers in the world.
No, there are other sets which do describe us.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay. It's good. Not,
right, but there are
good, good, good.
There are other sets that that don't have observers in them.
Right.
You know, take the wave function and divide it up into asking, is it still in this wave function? Is it not? Is it
right.
Not is it not? So is the idea that probabilities will only be assigned to sets that have human observers? I wrote some Sanders about this, and he said, that's a very good question. I'll get back.
That's what I was about to say. Let's see.
Because we need the probabilities in the other sets to define, for example, to try to give measures of what we mean by saying that something is classical. Because what's classical is...
Let's see. I guess Hillary might be able to speak to this, well, this better than I. But let me guess what Hillary might want to say, and then see if I'm right.
This is a device to confuse the innocent.
Okay, Hillary, I won't guess how you're gonna respond.
No, I don't really know whether it's a good question. Let's see. So. I guess I need to hear more about how you're going to use these probabilities. So quite aside from all these worries about how exactly probabilities
right.
make sense, I would have thought that any time you're actually going to be able to use them anyway, you're going to be in a situation where you can also
right.
research them in a certain theoretic picture.
Well, let me right. give you an example. Right. Let's suppose we'd like to define a measure on whether sets of histories are behaving classically. That's an example I really know. And part of that is that the sets of history should be predictive, that is close to being deterministic. That's defined by means of probabilities, right? Whether or not there are observers around to do that.
I'm
so
confused about something.
Right. I mean, there's no conflict of observations. That's
no, but wait. I guess I'm more on Hillary's side of this. I'm puzzled by something.
She hasn't said anything.
yeah, she actually has. She said something which sounds to me succinct and wise, which is she can't imagine a circumstance. Tell me if I'm paraphrasing incorrectly. She can't imagine a circumstance in which probabilistic talk would come up in a way that we could conceivably have any interest in that's distinctly outside of decision theoretic contexts.
So for example, you say you'd prefer or you want to know if you're attaching value to the presence of a classical world. Presumably that's some value you're attaching and you can...
The thing I was going to say is that in the way you talk, there seems to be a very easy slippage between the word probability and the word measure. And to the extent that slippage is easy, that's just a flat-out refusal even to entertain the problem that's being
but
raised
this
here.
Is a discussion yet to come. Right?
Right.
When I mean probability, I don't draw any distinction between probability and measure as far as I can.
Good. So for example, I can put a measure over the surface of this table.
Yeah.
And you think that would make it perfectly sensible to say, this little part of the table here, it's very unlikely.
No.
But I can put a measure over the surface of this table.
But
you're the one who seems to be saying that measure is synonymous with probability.
No, I didn't mean this quite to say that. I mean, I don't
because there's a really important distinction. I mean, an enormously,
what is the distinction?
Here's an example of the distinction.
Yeah.
It's easy to put a measure over the surface of this table. It's preposterous to say this little piece of the table is very implausible or very unlikely.
Yeah. David, let me give a try. Okay.
Yeah.
If we're to take seriously that the Schrodinger equation is deterministic, and that we are not inputting to the theory any distinction tantamount to the dualism of the Copenhagen interpretation, the one sentence version of what I want to say is, what's a decision if we're dealing with a deterministic theory? That is, does this deterministic theory if I look at the Hilbert space of this room,
yeah,
okay, for all the 10 to the 25, you know, particles, elementary particles in this room,
yes,
do I have to construct an operator that goes that singles out the possibility that there are biological beings which have big brains which do things which we call informally make decisions?
Yeah.
And if I'm unable to construct that operator from first principles and show that there's a significant, quote, measure,
yeah,
that there be such being. I mean,
if
you're really telling me there's an account of the world which doesn't put in the dualism of observer-system, then doesn't the system have to explain why there are things in the world that are called observers, and what in the world, on account of the deterministic theory, they do that is called informally making decisions?
About half the time you were speaking, I thought I understood you and disagreed, and the other half of the time, I'm not sure. So let me see. Here's what I thought I was understood and disagreed with. Okay, I don't think there is any particular tension between between on the one hand talking the language of decision theory, and on the other hand keeping very much in the foreground that one has a comprehensive account of the world which is completely deterministic.
No, that's just.
I think one can talk in classical mechanics about decision theory. One speaks in terms of counterfactual.
No, the issue is.
Okay.
We happen to like to talk informally of a basis in
which
there are biological beings and observers and they make decisions.
Right.
But as Jim often points out, there are lots of other bases, even that even satisfy the conditions of classicality, in which there are no such things.
Absolutely right.
In order to use a language of decision, aren't I picking out a basis, which is a very brittle, highly tuned, specially picked basis?
I don't know how brittle or highly tuned it is. There are certainly lots of others. It may even amount to a space of measure zero in the set of all possible bases, but none of that is to say it's terribly brittle. I'm also, of course, going to agree that we don't know how to explicitly write down such a basis, but it's also the case that we don't know any, I don't know of any compelling reason to think that talk like this is somehow senseless, or that it can be shown that no such basis exists, or something like that.
Just echoing Jim's question,
what
do I do with all the other bases in which there's nothing remotely like, quote, make a decision?
Yeah, I think Hillary's going to say those are descriptions of the world on which probabilistic talk doesn't interestingly come up. And I think there are, at the end of the day, there are going to be things wrong with Hillary's position. But I don't think
slightly further than that. It's not that it doesn't interestingly come up. It's that it's not.
It doesn't intelligibly come up. That's right. On the view that Hillary is trying to develop, probability talk is a kind of talk that emerges out of the more general discourse of making decisions and considering the behaviors of rational agents and so on and so forth. That's right.
So
that involves going to the basis where rational agents can be picked out and blah blah blah. And I don't see except that I see things down the road where I think this is not going to work out. I don't see anything wrong with that as it stands.
I feel myself at a real disadvantage here, and I apologize for not knowing about your work, but you made a very interesting statement about the work that's been done and how the probability interpretation is derived from some other concepts.
Right.
And obviously some people in this room
understand
all of that, but I don't.
Okay, so let me, so, good, good, good. Here's the idea. Here's the idea, I take it. It's clear that I'm not gonna get a significant portion of this talk done, but that's fine, because maybe it's more useful just to have some of these clarificatory discussions. Here's the idea, okay? People like Deutsch and Hillary and Simon Saunders sometimes and so on and so forth are going to respond to these very primitively expressed worries. Where's the probability? The theory is completely deterministic, and there's no relevant ignorance of initial conditions, blah, blah, blah. They're going to respond by biting the bullet. They're going to respond by saying, you know what? You're right, okay? There are no chances in this theory. There are no probabilities in this theory. And so the interlocutor then says, what are we going to do with all this probability talk in the theory? We don't know how to make sense of the theories making statements about the world without this probability talk. They say, here's what we're going to do. We think we have some arguments, okay, to the following effect. Suppose you were in such a world. There are no probabilities in this world, okay? What's going to happen for sure is that you're going to branch. You're going to experience both of these things with different amplitudes, whatever the hell that means, so on and so forth. We think we have an argument for the following claim, that if you were a rational agent, you knew you were about to split in this way, okay? And you ask yourself, and your goals are to maximize your financial holdings or something like that. We think we have an argument to the following effect. The way you would bet under circumstances where you knew you would branch, okay, is going to be exactly the way you would bet, okay, under different circumstances where you knew a chancy event was about to occur. Okay? So that the amplitudes, the quantum mechanical amplitudes in the absolutely non-probabilistic branching case are, as a matter of fact, going to end up playing the same role in your cognitive life. Okay? They're going to end up playing the same role in your decision theory as chances play in a chancy, in a genuinely chancy situation. And moreover, and this relates back to the discussion we've just been having, the role that chances play, the role that probabilities play in the cognitive decision theoretic lives of rational agents is all the role they play in the world. Okay? If we can recover that, that's a case of having recovered everything. That's the idea. I haven't given the argument. I'm about to give the argument and tell you why it's wrong. Okay? I haven't given the argument, but that's the idea. Is the idea clear? Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm sorry.
Minimize their financial.
No. You know the old Sidney Morgan Investor line that there's when you do decision theory, you have to start out by deciding what you want to maximize.
Yeah,
you know what you maximize in Jewish decision theory?
No.
Regret. Yeah.
Wait a minute. You didn't answer the question.
I'm sorry.
So do they have a different notion of probability?
No, they have a different. No, they have a different. They have a different thing that they wish to maximize.
The same notion of probability.
They'll have. According to these arguments, they'll have the same notion of probability. Okay. Well, they will bet differently because they wish to maximize regret or poverty or something.
It's one over the
thing. Right. That's right. That's right. Yes.
Could I just ask for a bit more clarification
on
Finn's point? So we're used to the fact that only a tiny subset of histories are decohering and can have probabilities assigned to them.
Right.
And then we have a discussion about what about the rest and so on.
Right.
But there's another issue, which is we would like to be able to assign probabilities to branches of the wave function before there were any people around. We'd like to see how a quasi-classical world is emerging from a quantum
big I think,
origin.
Right.
How are we to make sense
of that? I think the first thing these people are going to do is ask you very pointed questions about why you're so interested in assigning probabilities to those other cases.
Well, the point is,
why do you need it? What's it for?
Do we have to relate it to astronomical observations? We might.
Sure, but those are observations the astronomical observations are things that happen to us.
So long as everything is related back to observational
empirical
science.
Yes.
And you're on
the phone. That's the idea of the program. Yes.
But just to amplify on that, it's basically all of science. Why do we
consider
the history?
That's right. Okay. No, that's exactly
just to
right.
Simplify the prediction. So we're interested in the
probability. We're interested in what's going to happen to us.
In the early
that's
universe.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right. So you're answering on Hillary's behalf the very question you raised. That's right. Because if we've cleared up how these numbers function in decision theoretic contexts of anticipating and preparing for what's going to happen to us, we've cleared them up simpliciter. We've cleared them up completely.
Well, then why isn't that the answer to the other question?
Because the proposed clearing up doesn't work.
No,
okay.
Maybe I didn't make my question.
Okay.
So if you're willing to extend it back to the beginning of the universe, why aren't you willing to extend it to other sets that don't have observers?
Oh, if eventually, I thought you were talking about, I thought you were talking about sets from beginning to end where there are no observers ever.
Right.
Then you're just talking about a history where talk about observers isn't ever going to come up, where talk about making an experiment isn't ever going to arise, the probabilities are never going to come up. That's all. Okay, but as I take from your tone, I agree with it, that's not going to count as a problem for them. Okay. We're interested in the probabilities of various observations coming out various different ways. No observations, no probabilities, no problem. Okay. Good. Okay. So this is the strategy. Tom, I'm sorry, I'm about to answer the question that you actually asked, or about to begin to answer. So I have two worries about this. One is whether the detailed technical argument works. The other is whether the whole strategy makes any sense. Let me focus on the second question, the more abstract and general question first. The worry here is that the question at which this entire program is aimed, the question out of which this entire program arises, sounds, if you listen to it carefully, like the wrong question. The question to which this program is addressed are questions of what we would do if we believed that the fission hypothesis were correct. But the question at issue here is precisely whether to believe that the fission hypothesis is correct. And what needs to be looked into in order to answer that question doesn't have anything to do with how we would act if we believed that the answer to that question were yes. What needs to be looked into in order to answer the question of whether to believe the fission hypothesis is correct is the empirical adequacy of that hypothesis. What needs to be looked into in order to answer the question of whether to believe the fission hypothesis is correct is whether or not the truth of that hypothesis is explanatory of our empirical experience. And that experience is of certain particular experiments having certain particular sorts of outcomes with certain particular sorts of frequencies as opposed to other particular sorts of frequencies. And the Fisher hypothesis, since it's committed to the claim that all such experiments have all possible outcomes with all possible frequencies, is structurally incapable of explaining anything like that. The decision theoretic program seems to act as if what primarily and in the first instance stands in need of being explained about the world is why we bet the way we do. But this is crazy. Even if the arguments in question here were to succeed, even that is, if it could be demonstrated that any rational agent who believed the fission hypothesis would bet just like we do, that would merely show, that would be some kind of interesting science fiction story, okay? That is, that would merely show that circumstances can be imagined, circumstances which, mind you, are altogether different from those of our actual empirical experience, circumstances in which the business of betting on X has nothing whatsoever to do with the business of guessing at whether or not X is going to occur, circumstances in which nonetheless, we would bet the same way we bet now. Okay. For us, on the other hand, the business of betting on X has everything in the world to do with the business of guessing at whether or not X is going to occur. And the guesses we make are, in the best cases, a rational reaction to what we see. The guesses we make are, in the best cases, informed by the frequencies of relevantly similar occurrences in the past. And it's those frequencies, and not the betting behaviors to which they ultimately give rise, which make up the raw data of our experience. It's those frequencies, or at any rate, the appearance of those frequencies, and not the betting behaviors to which they ultimately give rise, which primarily, and in the first instance, stand in need of a scientific explanation. And the thought that one might be able to get away without explaining those frequencies or their appearances, the thought that one might be able to make some sort of an end run around explaining those frequencies or their appearances, which is the central thought of the decision theoretic strategy, is, when you think about it, crazy, like I said before. There's a sleight of hand here. Well,
I thought about it not enough to think it's crazy.
Okay, let's maybe there'll be more help in discussion. I guess at this point, I'm going to encourage. I mean, you want to?
So I guess what I expand.
What
I'm thinking is,
yes.
I think I should be able to reverse engineer this. So given that I get away with thinking about probabilities the way I do, and given that they seem to make sense,
right?
As I review my history with certain
right.
points and
right.
everything else, then it all must hang together. In the sense, in some simple-minded sense. And so, I'm not sure where.
Well, let's see. I'm not sure
that into.
So
are you bothered that? Just with the logic that, the sort of hierarchy of explanation, or are you thinking there's something actually inconsistent with my experience?
There's certainly nothing inconsistent. Oh, inconsistent with your experience. Okay. Yes,
so
I think there's something
inconsistent
with your experience.
This vision picture
right.
is inconsistent with my experience.
Well, I think the answer to that is yes, but in a way that needs to be expanded on. Look.
So freak me out.
Here's the idea, okay? Once again, what we want of our physical theories is to be empirically adequate, okay? What we want them to contain are explanations of the, as it were, the raw data. Philosophers are not supposed to say that there is any such thing, but we're among friends. What we want out of our fundamental physical theories is an account of the raw data of our empirical experience. Okay, good. What's the raw data that needs to be explained? I take it the raw data that needs to be explained are the relative frequencies of outcomes of various kinds of experiments. Okay. Well, of course, that can't be what the many worlds interpretation. Is in the business of explaining. It denies that there are facts about those frequencies. Okay, it says that all those frequencies for sure obtain. Okay, so here's what happens in the decision theoretic strategy. They say, no, that's not what we're going to try to explain. We've got something new that we're going to try to explain. We're going to act as if the raw data of our experience is our predilections to bet this way or that. Okay, and we're going to explain our predilections to bet this way or that. Okay, and we're going to say if the many worlds interpretation was true, this would be the right way to bet. Okay, this is the way we bet. Okay, so we've explained our empirical experience. Okay, the worry that's being voiced here is this is crazy. Okay, our betting behaviors are not the baseline. Raw data. The baseline raw data, the place where our betting behaviors and everything else comes from, are the observed frequencies. Okay? The strategy of the decision theoretic picture is to try to make an end run around producing an explanation of the frequencies, where they say, we're not going to give you an explanation of the frequencies. In fact, our business is denying that there are facts about those frequencies. Okay, but what we are going to produce an explanation of is the betting behavior. Okay, this is crazy. That's not the way our world is. What they've shown, if these arguments were right, now there's also a technical problem with these arguments, which we're about to get to. The arguments, in my opinion, are not correct. But if the arguments were correct, what they would show is, hey, here's an interesting story. There are conditions wildly different from the ones of our actual experience. In which it turns out we bet the same way. So what?
Is betting, betting experience, and that's whether we're being physicists or just walking down the street.
See, that's not my gut feeling. My gut feeling is I bet the way I do because of observed it because I'm extrapolating from observed frequencies in the past. Okay. My gut feeling is the baseline isn't anything like Betting behavior, okay. Betting behavior is a pretty high up business, okay, that is extracted from the baseline by inductive procedures or something like that, based on observed frequencies, okay. But they can't be in the business of explaining observed frequencies, that is, what the determinant frequencies are. They deny that there are facts about that. Yeah, Hillary's champing at the
okay. I think you're mischaracterizing the program at this point. So here are some things I agree with. The raw data for present purposes consists of relative frequencies. Those are the things that need explaining. Here's what's not true. It's not true that this decision theoretic strategy is trying to explain why we bet the way we do rather than why we saw the frequency we can do.
Uh-huh.
And it's not true that it's trying to...
Well, wait, but let me understand something. We ask on the many worlds interpretation, are there facts about the relative frequency with which this experiment came out this way? Answer, no.
There are facts about what the relative frequency was on the branch that we're now on.
That's true, but
that's like saying
none of the first five terms of the Taylor expansion have this or that property. Are there facts simpliciter about, are there facts, you know, on the metaphysical level about the frequencies with which such experiments come out such ways?
Sure, there
was. No. I mean, by a determinate fact, I mean a fact about them having come out one way as opposed to another.
Well, you know what the picture is. There are lots of branches. Different
yeah, yeah, I do know what the picture is. Let me ask you a perfectly analogous question. Is there a fact about the frequency of the electromagnetic radiation in this room? No. Is there a fact about the relative frequency with which, you know, with which this kind of experiment comes out this way on the Everett picture? No. So the Everett picture can't possibly be in the business of explaining why the relative frequency was such and such. It denies that there's a fact about the relative frequency having been such and such.
You're switching halfway through that paragraph from other facts about relative frequencies to our future. To are there facts about the relative frequencies to our past? The second thing is the thing that we need to explain, and the second thing is the thing that.
No, the second thing is a thing that the picture denies that there are facts about.
No, there is the thing that it agrees there are facts about.
Okay, I don't know what to say about.
Well, you draw one of these trees.
No, you don't put a "we are here" dot. You draw the tree, and the tree is the complete story of the world.
Right, and then you want to know which branch you're on and what.
No. This, I don't understand. Which branch? Which you is on? The original you? No. I don't understand this. The you that's asking the question. They're presumably all asking the question at the same time. The branch that which you was on. The complete picture
the one
of
that
the
has
world.
All the features that I do.
You mean the one that saw the one that saw this frequency? Of course, there are facts about the frequency that was seen by the one that saw this frequency. They absolutely don't need to be. That's just not true.
I don't think it matters if it's not.
I guess I do. We can go on with this, but look, it's really important. You know, the first couple of paragraphs of this talk were meant to flush out of the discussion any lingering ideas of there being a real me or an original me or anything like that. Okay, the picture that the theory gives us of the world is the tree. Okay, there's nothing further. That picture is complete. Okay, that picture doesn't stipulate. A certain set of facts as opposed to a certain other set of facts about what the frequencies are. As far as I can see, that's the end of the story, okay? And what's imaginative about the decision theoretic picture, it seems to me, is the willingness to say, you're right, I grant this, but I'm gonna have, I've got a story to tell you anyway.
Can you draw us a tree?
Sure. Is this a trick question?
No.
Here's a
tree. Two branches will be fine, and a trunk. Okay, and then a time axis.
Good.
And then 9:30.
No, actually, I'd like more than two branches. Good.
Okay. Now, 9:30 is somewhere on that time axis.
Okay.
You get to pick where it is.
Okay. Let's say it's here.
All right. Fine. Now, we're on one of those branches that you just drew a line.
I have no idea what that means.
Well,
I mean, the one who's on this branch is on this branch. I don't know how else to pick him out.
Well, presumably you divided the thing up into branches in the first place by saying something like, I'm going to flip a coin several times.
Yeah, so the one who observed all heads is on this branch.
Okay.
So the statement that this one observed all heads isn't a statement about how the world is. It's a tautology. It doesn't express any information. Of course, this one saw all heads. This one is defined as the one who saw all heads. There's no other way to pick out the one who saw all heads, or at least there doesn't need to be any other way to pick out the one who saw all heads, except to say, I'm thinking of the one who saw all heads. Okay. So to say this one saw all heads isn't any kind of claim about the world in the way that a claim like the frequency of heads in this series of coin flips was one, is a claim about the world.
I agree with that, but it's not a problem. So it's a familiar point that there's indexical information in addition to information about the objective state of the world, right?
No. Absolutely. You mean, no, it depends. If you're thinking of, say, somebody like Lewis, okay, who was interested in making this point, who made this kind of point very forcefully, it's not at all true that that's additional information. That's the same information on a different kind of presentation.
Okay, I think it's additional information.
Okay, but that's, okay, then, good. Maybe it's worked well. So maybe we've at least gotten to the point where it seems like you're granting that in order that there seems to be pressure to deny in some way, shape, or form the claim that the wave function is comprehensive as an account of what's going on.
It's comprehensive as an account of the objective state of
that's right. But there's more to say about it than that. That's right. Okay, good.
Davis, what was the final? Everything is fine until that last bit where you crystallize some difference, which I
okay. So here's the here's what I take to be the state of play at the moment. I was saying, look, Everett can't be in the business of explaining why the frequencies are this as opposed to that, because the theory denies that there are facts about what the frequency is. So that couldn't be the deal. So I was saying what I take to be the imaginative contribution of the decision theoretic strategy is to say, that's okay, maybe we don't need to explain that. We just need to explain why we bet the way they do, okay? Why we bet the way we do. And I said, that's crazy, that's not the baseline data. Hillary wanted to respond and say, no. The theory is in the business of explaining frequencies. I said, how could it be? There aren't any frequencies in the theory. All there is in the theory is this tree. Now Hillary wants to make the following distinction. No. All there is from what philosophers call the non-indexical standpoint, the objective standpoint. Indexicals are expressions like here or I or something like that, expressions whose meaning depends on who utters them and under what circumstances they are uttered, okay? There's an interesting thought that pops up now and again in the history of philosophy that maybe there are some facts about the world that can only be uttered in indexical language, okay? That have no objective representation, okay? Hillary is saying there are facts about these frequencies, which the theory proposes to explain, but they're among the sorts of facts that can only be uttered from an indexical standpoint. They have no objective third-person representation in the theory. That seems to me a concession more than one ought to want to make here. But I take it that's the state of play on this at the moment. Okay.
Could I
sure.
For one example?
Sure.
I mean, right now, the LHC is about to turn on. And a certain number of people are worried that it might make a black hole.
Right.
It will destroy the Earth.
Right.
Right. You can even read about it in the New York Times.
Right. Right. So, right. I understand that Posner, you know, this reactionary federal judge, recently wrote a book in which he considered such, he talked about risk in the law and so on and so forth, and considered such a possibility and did a decision theoretic analysis of whether we should turn it on that involved assigning a dollar value to the existence of the universe.
But the point is, right, there are no frequencies in the space. It's a single event, right, which is whether the, and my colleague Giddings, right, just spent the last 6 months.
Let's see, no, not according to the effort picture.
Wait, let me finish what I said.
Okay.
Spent the last 6 months calculating the probability.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
The Earth would be destroyed by this.
Yes. Planet. Yes.
What was he doing in your?
He was calculating the probability in a chancy theory like GRW or Copenhagen.
No, he wasn't.
Yes, he was.
not GRW. Are you sure?
The calculation he was doing yielded an answer very close to what the GRW he was doing. Whether he knew what he was doing is another question. Okay, what he was in fact doing, if one wants to charitably understand what he, if one wants to charitably rationally reconstruct what he was doing calculations in a chancy theory. And of course, there's a chance that such calculations will yield a numerical value for the chance that a black hole will be formed and eat up the world.
He was trying to get a number which instructs us how to bet.
That's right.
The LHC.
No. He was calculating the chance that the world would be destroyed. Yeah. That's what he was doing. That's what he was doing. There are only chances in theories with chances in them.
David, I have a conjecture about the discussion generally in this room at the moment and generally about this issue and also about other kind of multi-world issues.
Right.
And I think you put your finger on it because there are two discussions going on across purposes. There are some people who believe the effort picture,
right,
who believe eternal inflation,
right,
universes, okay? And then ask the question, okay, what do I need to do to show that this is consistent with my beliefs, with my other beliefs about the world and about my experience?
Right.
Okay. And if they can answer that positively, believe that they've done something useful.
Right.
There are other people who are asking the question that you're asking of, I need a reason to believe this account rather than a competing account. And the two things are very different. The logic of the two things are very different.
I think I'm discussing the first, not the second. I'm not mentioning, I mentioned them now.
You're saying precisely. Okay.
But what I don't see myself in this talk as weighing Everett against
something else. No, not against any particular one. But
right.
You're saying, okay, somebody believes Everett. I need a positive reason to believe it. I need an argument to believe in the whole story about branches, et cetera.
Right.
Okay. And a positive reason for you would be an explanation that would be in your terms empirically adequate, which means an explanation of
If that's what you mean by a positive, that's what I would call the absence of a negative reason, okay? I want the theory to be empirically adequate. And there's an argument here that it's not.
Yeah, in the standard terms.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I think it's a discussion to have tomorrow or, in another discussion. The same logic is going on in some accounts of eternal inflation and those
right. I think that may be true. Right.
And I think it's very important to underline it that the burden is not just to have an account of a weak form of consistency
right.
of your theory with your beliefs.
Right.
Okay. The point is to have, in the standard sense, something that justifies the empirical adequacy of theory.
Right. Let me amplify that just a little bit. Here's a point that I think has been useful broadly in foundations of quantum mechanics in examining some of these proposals for solving the measurement problem. Here's what strikes me as a useful difference to keep in mind, okay, between a scientifically interesting proposal and what you might want to call merely a non-refutable skeptical hypothesis. Okay. There's a certain straightforward sense in which, say, something like Everett is obviously compatible with our experience. Okay. One of the branches in there is our experience. Okay.
Whatever our experience is,
one of the branches in there is our experience. Okay. That's not very interesting. That's enough to show. That's like saying, for all we know, the world could have been created along with our memories 5 seconds ago, so on and so forth. Okay. We want a good deal more out of a scientifically interesting hypothesis, and this is a discussion I was going to get to later in this talk. I don't know if I will. One of the things we want is an account, for example, of how, if the world were such and such a way, among the things that the world's being that way could account for is investigators in that world coming to have good reasons for believing that the world was that way. Okay. Take the hypothesis of the world having been created 5 minutes ago along with our memories. There can't be any doubt that this is compatible with our experience. There can't be any doubt that this is successful as a skeptical hypothesis. Okay. What's much harder to see is how it could be the case that beings in that sort of world could come to have good empirical reasons for believing that's the way the world was. That's what makes it uninteresting as a scientific hypothesis, even as interesting and successful as a skeptical scenario. Okay. That's just sort of to echo what you said. Okay. Here's my rhetorically thrilling summation of this first general category of work about the aim of the whole program. I'm going really late, aren't I?
Yeah.
I should. Okay, you know what I should do?
How about the half an hour more?
Oh, sure. Okay. Oh, that's fine. Okay. It's
working really well from my point of
view. Okay, good. Good. No, that's right. I mean the measure is, you know, what the group gets out of it rather than whether I get to the end of the talk. Right. Good. Okay. So here's what I think about the whole orientation of the program. There's a sleight of hand going on here. There's a bait and switch kind of move going on here. What we need, and this is what one has to keep one's eye on, what we need is an account of our actual empirical experience of frequencies. And what we get promised in this program, which falls, it seems to me, entirely short of what we need, is an account of why we bet the way we do. Okay? And what we're given, which falls entirely short even of what we were promised, is an argument to the effect that if we held an altogether different set of convictions about the world than the ones that we actually hold, we would bet the same way as we actually do. And to top it all off, this brings me to the more concrete and more technical sorts of worries, I think the argument even for that turns out to be wrong. Yeah, Hillary.
I'm sorry, just okay again.
Sure.
You won't be here tomorrow, so
I'll just... Right.
Okay. So I just wanted to say something about this, the claim that what we really want to know is what we should do given our actual situation, and you decision theoretic guys talking about this altogether different situation where we've somehow
right.
to believe that this many world theories true.
Right.
So I just want to say something about what I take to be going on there. Okay, so we do claim that it is going to end up being relevant at the end of the day to consider how we bet or how rational agents bet and so forth. But we agree that if the issue we're interested in, which it is the issue of theory confirmation,
right,
then we need to be talking about agents who have non-zero credence that the world is branching, but also significant
right.
non-zero credence
right.
that the world is not branching.
Right.
And as I see it, the point of thinking about agents who have somehow become convinced that the many worlds theory is true and working out how they would bet is that that's going to have implications for the general betting strategy of an agent who's not sure. What you're going to do is you're going to calculate the decision theoretic value of a branch in multiple ways in that first tactic.
Right.
And then you're going to embed it in your more general decision theoretic.
Right. Now, as you know, that's an argument that I get to later in the paper and probably won't have a chance to get to today. And maybe the only thing to do is to register my conviction that that confirmation theory argument suffers from similar, doesn't go through. I feel stupid just announcing things like that without having the time to back them up. Let's see how far we get, and maybe we'll get into it. Okay. Let's go to the detailed argument. Look, these arguments typically ask us to consider the following set of circumstances. Let this thing, alpha payoff, okay, represent the state of the world in which I'm given a certain sum of money, and in which the state of the rest of the world is alpha. And let beta, no payoff, represent the state of the world in which I'm given no money, and in which the state of the rest of the world is beta. And suppose that my only interest, so here now we're focusing, so once again, to keep the logic straight. I've already tried to argue that the business of showing how we would bet is not going to do the trick here. But for the moment, we're putting those worries aside and just asking whether there is, in fact, an argument about how I would be rationally constrained to bet under these circumstances. Okay, good. Suppose that my only interest is in maximizing my wealth. Suppose, in particular, that I'm altogether indifferent as to whether alpha or beta is the state of the remainder of the world. Then, so the argument goes, on pain of irrationality, the utility I ought to associate with this, with things coming out like this, ought to be equal to the utility I would associate with things coming out like this, because those two states differ only in terms of the role of alpha and beta, and I am, by stipulation, indifferent as to whether it's alpha or beta that obtains in the rest of the world. That, at any rate, is what these arguments claim. And that claim goes under the name of equivalence in the literature. And it turns out that once the hypothesis of equivalence is granted, the game is over. It turns out that supposing equivalence amounts to supposing that whatever it is that plays the fundamental role of probabilities can depend on nothing other than the quantum mechanical amplitudes, and it turns out to be relatively easy to argue from there to the conclusion that these so-called functional probabilities can be nothing other than the absolute squares of those amplitudes. Okay. The worry is that the initial plausibility of this hypothesis seems, on reflection, to melt away. For suppose I adopt a Caring measure, which, contra the equivalence hypothesis, depends on the difference between alpha and beta. Suppose, for example, that I decide that the degree to which it's reasonable for me to care about what transpires on some particular one of my future branches ought to be proportional to how fat I am on that branch. The thought being that since there's more of me on the branches where I'm fatter, those branches deserve to attract more of my concern for the future. Would there be something incoherent or irrational or unreasonable or less reasonable than the standard measure in that? Would it somehow make less sense for me to adopt my fatness as a Caring measure than it would for me to adopt the absolute square of the quantum mechanical amplitude as a Caring measure? Let's think it through. Hillary has pointed out to me, very helpfully, that a Caring measure which depends exclusively on how fat I am probably isn't going to work. Since the coherence of a measure like that is going to depend on there being some perfectly definite matter of fact about exactly how many branches there are, and there are very unlikely to turn out to be any facts like that. But this is easily remedied. By replacing the naive fatness measure, the one that depends exclusively on how fat I am, with a slightly more sophisticated one. Let the degree to which I care about what transpires on a certain branch, then, be proportional to how fat I am on that branch, multiplied by the absolute square of the amplitude associated with that branch. It's sometimes been suggested, David Wallace at one point suggested this, that moving from the standard quantum mechanical square amplitude carrying measure to this sophisticated form of the fatness carrying measure is, as a matter of fact, when you get right down to it, notwithstanding superficial appearances to the contrary, not really a case of my changing my carrying measure at all, but rather a case of my changing my preferences, like you were worried about with the Buddhists. A case of deciding that I want not only to be rich, but to be fat as well. It's sometimes been suggested, to put it slightly differently, that my adopting such a measure would somehow be inconsistent with the claim, or somehow irrational in light of the claim that I am, as a matter of fact, entirely indifferent as to whether I'm fat or thin. But this is a mistake. I can perfectly well have no preference at all when faced with a choice between two different non-branching deterministic future evolutions, in one of which I get fat and in the other of which I get thin, and at the same time be very eager to arrange things when I'm faced with an upcoming branching event, so as to ensure that things are to my liking on the branch where I'm fatter. What would explain such behavior? What would make sense of such behavior? Precisely the conviction I mentioned above, that where branching events are concerned, but only where branching events are concerned, there's more of me to be concerned about on those branches where I'm fatter. In the non-branching cases, no such considerations can come into play, since in those cases, the entirety of me, fat or thin, is on the single branch to come. So, although my present concern about the overall well-being of my descendants is in general going to involve caring a great deal about their relative fatnesses, those same fatnesses are going to be no concern at all to the descendants themselves. And once again, there's nothing worrisome or paradoxical or mysterious in that. In cases of branching, after all, there's no reason at all why my interests at T1, vis-a-vis the circumstances of my descendants at T2, should coincide with the interests of any particular one of my descendants at T2, vis-a-vis his circumstances at T2. In cases of branching, my concerns now are going to embrace the entire weighted collection of my descendants. Weighted, I guess, is a pun there. Whereas their concerns are going to embrace only their individual selves and their descendants. David Wallace has pointed out again that acting in accord with a fatness measure, caring measure, might sometimes prove difficult in practice. It might, for example, involve my trying to anticipate or even taking measures to control how much I'm going to eat on this or that future branch. Now, difficulties like that could presumably be reduced or even eliminated altogether by other choices of a caring measure, but the more important point is that the existence or non-existence of such difficulties seems altogether irrelevant to the question of what it's reasonable for me to care about. It hardly counts as news, after all, that it can sometimes be difficult to bring about the sorts of situations that we judge most desirable. But it would be absurd to pretend that those situations are any less desirable for that. Forget for the moment about quantum mechanics and about branching and about chances, and consider the business of making a decision. Consider the business of tracing out the consequences of my acting in such and such a way at such and such a moment, all the way out to the end of time, in the face of a classical mechanical sort of determinism. Consider how easy it might be to imagine that my choosing to go to my going to movie A rather than going to movie B tonight might result in the deaths of millions of innocent people over the next several hundreds of thousands of years. We just don't know. We can't know. The calculations are utterly and permanently and inescapably beyond. Ought we to pretend then that we don't care how many millions live or die as a result of what we do? Ought we to come to understand that, as a matter of fact, it doesn't matter to us how many millions live or die as a result of what we do? Of course not. We do the best we can with what we have to bring about what we want. And what we find we cannot do is occasion for sadness and for resignation, and not at all for concluding that it was somehow irrational to want it in the first place. The worry, then, is that equivalence on reflection turns out to be false. And more than that, the worry is that it's, in fact, not one whit less rational in the face of the conviction that something like the fission picture is true for me to operate in accord with the sophisticated fatness measure than it is for me to operate in accord with the Born measure. And if that's true, then there can be no uniquely rational way of operating under such convictions at all, and the whole argument falls apart. Yeah, Hilary.
As you know, Anthony Valentini's done a lot of work on hidden variables at a quantum equilibrium. Have you thought at all about what happens if you try piggybacking on those probability distributions to generate counterexamples?
That's a good question.
I wonder if they run into the same sort of...
That's a good question. No, I haven't, but that's a nice thing to try to think through. Hmm. Let me... I wonder if this is the right... Yeah, okay, what the hell. Last time I was at Perimeter, as a matter of fact, there was an interesting argument, by no means the only interesting argument that Bergman produced, but there was an interesting argument that Zurek presented that I heard for the first time that goes like this. This is a very different argument, an argument, as I said, due to Zurek, an argument that makes crucial and imaginative use of the locality of the Fission fiction in a way that none of these other arguments do, to the effect that any rational agent who believes in the Fission fiction has got to bet as if the probability of the outcome of a measurement of, say, the Z-spin of an electron, which is initially a member... So, let me depart from the text here. Here's what Zurek imagined. Imagine that you have a pair of electrons in a singlet state, okay? He says, okay, I'm going to give you an argument from locality that a rational agent would be crazy to have any credence other than 50%, any credence other than a half, in the proposition that a measurement of the x-spin of the electron number one is going to yield spin up. Okay? Here's the argument. Look. Imagine that you put a field, you apply an external field to particle number one, okay? The kind of external field that will flip its Z-spin, okay? He says it must be the case that whatever the agent's credences are, applying that field ought to exchange his credences in spin up and spin down. Okay, everybody with me so far? Moreover, once that's been done, by applying a similar field to the other particle, you can fully reconstruct the original singlet state, the original quantum state. Moreover, by locality, applying the external field to particle two should have no effect on his credences vis-a-vis particle one. Okay? So here's the deal. You do this, the thing flips. Okay? You do something else that reconstitutes the original state, that must return the credences here to their original values, okay? So flipping the but this second operation must have no effect on those credences, okay? So it must be the case that flipping the credences leaves them with their original values, okay? That must mean that the credences were originally a half. Everybody see this argument? A very pretty argument. Completely wrong. The trouble with this argument, and this was precisely the trouble with the hypothesis of equivalence as well, is that it takes for granted that an agent's credences in the outcomes of upcoming measurements on this or that physical system can depend on nothing other than the quantum state of the system just prior to the measurements taking place. And that's what we've just now learned isn't right. The listener should at this point have no trouble at all in confirming for herself, for example, that the fatness measure provides just as straightforward a counterexample to Zurek's argument as it does to the hypothesis of equivalence. Okay. Good. How much more time should I take? 5 minutes or something?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me get a little bit to that's what I'll do, and I'll just throw out the rest of the stuff. Good. Let me address a little bit what Hilary was saying about confirmation a few minutes ago. Let's back up and come at all this again from a slightly different angle through the question of confirmation. Advocates of the Fission hypothesis have argued, like Hilary, that there's a very straightforward generalization of the standard Bayesian technique of confirmation, which can be applied to branching and to stochastic theories alike. And moreover, that such an application shows how the Fission picture is confirmed by our empirical experience of the world to precisely the same degree and by precisely the same evidence as a stochastic theory governed by the Born rule is. And if all this is right, as Hillary said a few minutes ago, then much of what I've been saying here must somehow be wrong. Hillary has pointed out, for example, that if all this is right, then there just cannot be an objection to the Fission hypothesis, to the effect that that hypothesis cannot explain the frequencies of the outcomes of standard quantum mechanical experiments, since, after all, it's precisely those frequencies that are confirmatory of the Fission hypothesis. But it turns out that the application of Bayesianism to the Fission hypothesis that investigators like Hillary and Wayne Myhrvold, who she wrote an interesting paper with about this, have in mind is in fact much less standard and much less straightforward and much less innocent than advertised. And this will be worth explaining carefully. And it'll be best to start at the beginning. Any sensible strategy for updating one's credence in this or that scientific theory in light of one's empirical experience of the world has presumably got to be a matter of considering how well or how poorly that experience bears out the proposition that the theory in question is true. Any sensible strategy for updating one's credence in this or that scientific theory in light of one's empirical experience of the world has presumably got to be a matter of evaluating how well or how poorly the theory does in predicting what is going to happen. In the standard Bayesian account of confirmation, for example, we decide how to update our credence in hypothesis H in light of some new item of evidence E by evaluating what the probability of E would be if H were true. And our credence in H goes up, other things being equal, if E is the sort of occurrence that H counts as likely. Put that beside the discussions I mentioned above of Bayesian confirmation, or maybe neo-Bayesian confirmation, or maybe faux Bayesian confirmation in the Fission picture. The way Greaves and Myhrvold set things up, what needs to be evaluated there is not what the probability of E would be if H were true, but rather how we would bet on E if we believed that H were true. And what they recommend is that those of my descendants who witness E ought to raise their credence in H, other things being equal, if E is the sort of occurrence that I would have bet on if I had believed that H were true. But remember, and this is the absolutely critical point, that deciding whether or not to bet on E in the Fission picture has nothing whatsoever to do with guessing at whether or not E is going to occur. It is going to occur, for sure. And so is not E. And the business of deciding how to bet is just a matter of maximizing the payoffs on those particular branches that, for whatever reason, I happen to care most about. And if one is careful to keep all that at the center of one's attention, and if one is careful not to be misled by the usual rhetoric of making a bet, then the epistemic strategy that Greaves and Myhrvold recommend suddenly looks, I don't know, profoundly unmotivated. There surely is a perfectly legitimate question. Well, let me see how much that gets into details. You know, there's a lot more to say about all this in discussion, but maybe I ought to leave it maximally open for discussion and leave it there. Yeah.
At the risk of casting further doubt on this.
Yes.
The tree over there raises or reopens the discussion we had earlier, because Hillary seems to want to say that some of those branches are different from other branches because they should be lit up because they have conscious observers.
No, she doesn't want to say that. Okay. Hillary will confirm that she doesn't want to say
that. Okay. Now, a lot of people might, because you see, some of those branches will correspond to where the CERN experiment goes wrong and the universe is transformed and there are no observers left,
right.
And their branches.
Right, and everybody loses a lot of money.
We need to, if we're going to consistently assign probabilities to decohere branches, we have to take those into account as well as the ones that are lit up.
Right.
So now we're back to the question.
But wait, I didn't understand the talk of lit up.
Right.
There's the talk about being lit up by consciousness. I mean, if this is an objection to what I said at the beginning of the talk, that's fine, but let's discuss it. In the very beginning of the talk, I said, look, if you have anything in the back of your mind, like lit up, or where the real me is, or where the conscious me is, you've got to purge it in order not to become badly confused, because the effort, what Everett is supposed to be committed to, okay, is that this tree is the, at least, you know, modulo what I was talking about with Hillary a few minutes ago, is at least the complete objective picture of the world. There are no additional facts about which branches lit up or so, anything like
that. But so you're saying that all the branches are lit up?
Either all of them are or none of them are. That's right. But I think in your language, the right thing to say is all of them are lit up.
So, yes. So that means that all conceivable branchings,
yes,
must have conceivable observational consequences, or they don't go in to your algorithm for computing probabilities. So this tree has to be truncated. All sorts of branches have to be chopped off because they are, in principle, unobservable by anybody.
You mean because there are no people in those branches?
Or aiguses of any nature, maybe.
No, I don't think anything has to be chopped off. There's the condition the world is in at 9:30 is this one.
Okay. Isn't this something cut off because the carry measure be zero on those branches?
The carry measure might be zero on those branches. But the condition of the world is exactly this one. Okay. Then we can talk about, you know, then people might want to talk about how you ought to bet. The technical portion of this paper, the portion where I was talking about the equivalence hypothesis, was meant to show that there isn't going to be any argument that you should bet one way or another. Okay.
But we still have to take into account branches like baby universes that have got no conceivable observers.
Sure. Yeah, they're in the world. Right.
And how do you extract the subset of those branches that are in principle observable from the totality?
I don't see why you need to.
Because if you're going to try to put some measure on the space of this, which is the whole purpose of this, isn't it, is to recover the born ansets or something similar. Don't you have to take into account all the branches, including those?
You do have to take into account. I'm being dense. I'm not sure. Maybe Hillary understands better what you're asking.
I'm not sure, but so is the right thing to say here? Okay, if you want to run this sort of decision theoretic strategy for explaining what you mean by probability,
you need this.
What you need is you need there to be an observer on the branch to the future of which.
Right, or somewhere in its course.
What you don't need is for there to be an observer on each of those branches in the future.
Right.
You just need one on the common trunk. Is that the...
You mean some of those branches are not directly observed? But
right, so suppose it's the case that there's an observer on the trunk at the bottom of David's diagram, and then of the eight branches at 9:30, only six of them have observers on, and the others have gone into heat death or whatever.
Right.
That's not going to be a problem. The guy on the trunk down at the bottom before 9:30 is still going to be able to put a measure on the set of eight later branches, and it's still going to count as probability according to this program.
You mean for making predictions? That's
right.
Good.
Right.
You can still say things like there's a probability of 1/8 that heat death will occur
right.
in 10 minutes.
The problem is in something like quantum cosmology, what you want to do, we're living now, and we're inferring facts about the past, and you want to, the many histories, and you want to put some sort of measure on that as well. Isn't that right, Jim? I mean,
yes, sure.
Right. And then you have to start talking about hypothetical priors, but the claim is ordinary Bayesians and Chancy theories have to do that too.
Right.
So.
I think that's right.
So the one moment which was unexpected for me, perhaps you could just elaborate a little
right.
more on if you think it's worth it.
Sure.
There definitely was a moment, I thought, where Hillary was talking about us being on that branch, mm-hmm. as opposed to the issue which you you know, explained so well that that kind of talk doesn't really make any sense in this picture.
Right.
So that is, and then this indexical notion. Came
okay. Out, so look, really this is.
And that seems to be the.
This is something you know the. I mean, life is tough, and there is one of the things that's a little frustrating about these discussions is that there are a whole, you know, we've gotten a very small sampling of it here. There are a whole bunch of different people with somewhat different arguments about these things, and it's hard to try to respond to all of them at once. But let me say a little bit about this indexical business. This actually, I'm hearing, you know, this is a kind of talk that I associate much more with Simon Saunders than with Hillary. But maybe I'm just wrong about that. Maybe I didn't fully understand your view. Here's what I take it, and Hillary, you're very invited to break in. Here's what I take it the discussion was like. Okay, here was the view I presented. Look, here's the strategy, here's the cute idea of the decision theoretic strategy. Okay, forget about explaining frequencies. Okay, we're not going to make any attempt to explain frequencies. Now, I understand that Hillary's going to disagree with this, but let me lay out the view and then lay out what I think Hillary's contributed. So the idea of the decision theoretic strategy was, forget about frequencies. We're not going to explain frequencies. There are no facts about frequencies. That's all absolutely correct. But that's okay. Okay. Why is it okay? Because even though there are no facts about frequencies, and of course we can't explain them, there aren't even any facts about them, is we can explain why we bet the way we do. Okay. And if we succeed in explaining why we bet the way we do, we've done as much as we need to do. Okay, now, I had two sorts of objections to that. One was, no, that's not what we ought to be explaining, okay? Our betting behaviors are not the baseline data, okay? The baseline data are the frequencies. That's what we should be explaining. Moreover, what they claim explains the way we bet the way they do, we do, doesn't. That was the point of the whole factness measure discussion. Okay, Hillary, I think, wanted to say, and like I say, I didn't know that this was her view either. Hillary wanted to say, no. I don't agree that I'm giving away from the word go the project of explaining the frequencies. And I said, well, how could you not be giving that away? There aren't facts about the frequencies in this picture. And Hillary's response is something like, not so fast. There aren't objective facts about the frequencies in this picture. There are indexical facts about the frequencies in this picture. Okay. There's been, when somebody says, when I say the chair is right here, okay. That's not what you might call a deeply indexical proposition, because even though it uses an indexical here, we can easily imagine replacing it, okay, with a statement like, the chair is right next to David Albert, okay, which is in perfectly objective, non-indexical language, and so it's not what you might call an essentially indexical point. It's long been something philosophers have wondered about, whether there are facts in the world about the way the world is, which it's proper to call essentially indexical, okay? Facts which can't be stated in non-indexical language, but which are real facts. Here's a nice classical example. I guess this is an example a little bit retooled by me. This is not Lewis's original example, but here's what I think is a cute example. Imagine, this is perfectly classical. Imagine that the world includes, among other things, two brains, okay? And lots of other stuff too, but there are two, at a certain moment in the history of the world, there are two brains. Those brains as it happens, are both in identical neurological states at that moment. And moreover, it's a feature of both of those states that each of those brains has, you know, forget about problems of self-reference, has an essentially complete map of the physical state of the world in its head at that moment, okay? And among the things that both of these brains know, okay, is that the one on the left is about to be hit on the head by a rock, okay? There's a rock heading for the one on the left. There's no rock heading for the one on the right, okay? Good. Both of these brains know all that, okay? Both of these brains know the complete physical state of the world now. In fact, they know the complete history of the world, okay? And Lewis points out, in an example a little different from this, but it can be easily adapted to this. Lewis says, but look, it seems like both of these brains could perfectly well be wondering at this moment, whoops, I wonder if I'm the one who's about to get hit on the head. Nothing that they know seems to settle that question. Okay, there's a thought that this kind of thing might be an example of an essentially indexical question. Okay, Lewis thought about this and concluded that it wasn't. Okay, it's a long story, and moreover concluded that there aren't essentially indexical questions, and so on and so forth. That's a long story. Anyway.
Sorry, can I ask a dumb question?
Yeah, sure.
How can they be in identical mental states if they're not even receiving the same visual inputs?
Because just posit that they are. An evil genius prepared them in these states. Both of their eyes are closed now. Okay.
It's coming from the back.
All that's right. It's coming from the back. Okay. All their eyes are closed. Okay. But they know. Okay. That this is what the state of the world is now. They just don't know where they are in it. Okay. That is. What's the difference between what you know? The difference in this case is by producing two identical mental states. Okay, we have cut off the possibility of figuring out where I am in the world by saying, well, I know I'm the brain with these, having these thoughts.
You took away knowledge That's, by forcing them to have identical states.
I guess you could put it that way. Yes. They have identical states. But look, here's the puzzle. Both of them know the complete physical state of the world now. But both of them can also think of a question, although a question which necessarily has to be posed in indexical language, but which sounds like a real question. Am I about to get hit on the head?
It sounds to me like
they don't know how to answer.
I thought a complete physical description of the world would include knowledge about who is about to get hit on the head.
But there is knowledge about it. The one on the right is about to get hit on the head. The one near the Statue of Liberty is about to get hit on the head. What I don't know is whether that one is I. Okay. So anyway, this is to titillate you with this thought that there is this long history of philosophical speculation that there might be essentially indexical statements, that there might be some sense in which an objective third person description of the world is incomplete. Hillary seems to be invoking this, okay, in order to hang on to the claim that there are facts about frequencies in these worlds, but they're not objective facts, they're essentially indexical facts.
Is that a fair
account of the...
Yeah, not though. So you say that Lewis decided in the end that the cases like the
right.
one he described are not cases of essentially indexical.
Right.
I don't know about that literature, so if there's some subtle trick that he uses, maybe the same trick.
Okay.
As far as I can see at the moment, yeah.
Okay, good. This is a long discussion, a shamefully philosophical discussion. At the end of the day, I would consider this a fairly desperate maneuver for a physical theory.
Well, that's the question. Yes. As a physicist, should we consider this as a...
I don't think
we
so.
Might need to care about
it? I don't think
so.
Do I need to stop?
I think maybe this is a question to both Hillary and David. Is this use of an indexical, this branch of the wave function playing the same role here, that if I'm a presentist rather than an eternalist about time, the speaking of now or the present moment plays?
Yeah.
No, it's playing the same role as speaking of now plays if you are an eternalist.
Speaking of what?
Speaking of now plays.
Oh, if you are an eternalist.
So the other time
right.
is real, but
right.
I'm not
right. out. Right. I think that's a good way. I think that's a good answer.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good.
So let's thank David for fascinating.